Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, using horror novels to make sense of a Phoenix childhood, and how one Arizona EV maker is repurposing the remains of another. But first, as the Trump administration continues to pursue deep cuts to federal spending, artists and scholars around the country are having their grants abruptly revoked. Millions of dollars in funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the National Science Foundation has already been cut off, creating chaos and uncertainty for recipients who were counting on it. Nicole Walker is a professor at NAU, whose team recently lost an NSF grant, and she joins me now to talk about what happened. Nicole, good morning.
Hi, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for being here. Before we get to what happened with the funding for this project, let's talk about the project itself. This was a program called Process. What was the goal?
So the goal was to bring STEM students, usually freshmen who had already begun their studies at NAU, and to work with them over the summer on particular research projects, but also combining creative writing and artists to encourage their creativity in their science projects and to bring their hone their communication skills to better express what's happening with their sciences and to institute with them a commitment to their education across disciplines. So it's a really innovative program that we worked with the students in the summer, and then they took creative writing classes and art classes along with their science and their biology and math classes. So they had this very interdisciplinary experience their second year and then hopefully on to their junior and senior years of college.
Tell us a little bit about what that looked like for the students in a practical sense as the program was unfolding. Like how would they move through their day?
Yes. Yeah, so in the mornings during the summer, these 5 weeks in the summer, they would go into the field and they would study burn scars and the area around burn scars. You know, we're in Flagstaff where we have a lot of forests, so we have a lot of wildfires. And they study how the microorganisms regenerate, how the plants regenerate, if invasive species come into the area, what kind of pollinator species might be joining them. And then they take some of that material back to the lab and further study it. But on some of the days, we would take that information and we would help them write creatively about these materials they brought home into the field or their field experience, or we would talk about how they might use them in art installations. We presented different kinds of art projects to them. For example, there's this great artist who has in Seattle has incorporated a nurse log, which is one of a fallen tree, but these fallen trees that are necessary for the forest, and a whole new forest essentially grows from within this nurse log. And so you combine the science and the art, inspiring creativity and curiosity in various, you know, your people who you're trying to convey your particular science project to. So we would do a lot of discussions about art and science. We would do a lot of presentations, but we'd also invite them to write their own short stories, poems, essays, do their own paintings, drawings, and then they would go back in the field. And again, that sort of circular commitment to their science and their creative projects meant that they became more identified with the project they were putting together.
Yes. I was reading that one of the goals here is to not just, you know, inspire the interdisciplinary spirit here, but also to increase STEM identity for students.
Exactly. And, you know, this grant was directed toward underrepresented students. And one of the concerns is that people don't see themselves as scientists as readily as we'd like, that they don't have that connection to what it looks like to be a scientist in the field, what it means to inhabit that scientific identity. And so the idea of writing about it or drawing and painting about it is to say, look, this can be you. You can be this thing, and you can, it can encompass all, you know, your various parts of yourself.
Yeah. Well, so as I understand it, about 2 weeks ago, you had just met the cohort of students you were going to be working with for this summer. You guys had a pizza party, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right.
And then you got an email. Tell us about this email.
Yeah. So Saturday morning, I woke to an email with a subject line that said process project, not good, where I read that our grant had been summarily terminated and there was no appeal, and that we would be working with the Office of Sponsored Projects on how to wind down whatever parts of the grant were left, which aren't very many, because we, besides the pizza party, this year's cohort hadn't really started their research. They hadn't moved to NAU's dorms where they would be living. Summer income hadn't started yet. So all of the cutting off was, I guess, easy to do, although incredibly painful.
Yes. Well, and it doesn't seem like it leaves the students a lot of time to make alternate plans for the summer.
Exactly. This is, I think, the most gutting part, is the program pays these students for 5 weeks and houses them and counts as an internship. And so they have all of their, you know, a bulk of their summer was dedicated to this. Now they have to scramble for jobs. Who knows if they're going to be able to find housing? And the commitment, you know, that we made to them, it feels like we have betrayed them. And I feel terrible that these students have no real prospects for the summer.
Well, just about 30 seconds left here, Nicole. I know that you've been hearing from some other colleagues about similar situations. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, it's really upsetting. For example, I'm working with a researcher in Alaska who has indigenous scholars that are working on a grant with her, and that grant was entirely cut. There's a spreadsheet that my friends in the arts have compiled of grants that were canceled by the National Endowment for the Arts. When I last looked, there were 222 grants that had been cut at a total of $6,296,000. And that was just in one day. So we're just, you know, everyone's in shock. We don't know how these, you know, especially in the arts, how we're going to build back, if we can build back and build up. I know private donations are part of our plan, but again, we're at a loss. The people who are losing grants from the National Science Foundation, the National Institute of Health, it feels like chaos, and I don't know how we are going to put everything back together.
Well, we thank you very much for coming on to tell us your story, Nicole. That is Nicole Walker, professor at Northern Arizona University. Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you, Sam.
Electric vehicle maker Lucid last month bought assets and facilities from another car maker, Nikola Motors. The latter had filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Both companies have, or had, major presences in Arizona. As part of the deal, Lucid bought a Nikola manufacturing site in Coolidge and a development center in the Valley. Lucid will also hire an estimated 300 former Nikola employees. To discuss this deal and what it may mean for the EV market and Arizona's place in it, my co-host Mark Brody spoke with Tony Quiroga, editor-in-chief of Car and Driver, and they started with how significant this deal could be.
Well, you know, I think it gives them some ability to manufacture more product, and Nikola has their fuel cell technology, which I think they also bought into. So I don't know where that's going. I mean, right now, Lucid is an entirely battery electric vehicle manufacturer. So I'm not really sure what it means that they've purchased this. But that said, there's probably a lot of know-how there locally, and a lot of smart people work there. So they probably wanted to tap into that workforce.
What does it say about the EV landscape that, you know, Nikola was not allowed to just sort of fade into obscurity, but that Lucid at least saw some value in continuing or you know, acquiring this company?
Well, I imagine they see that there's a lot of smart people over there that know what they're doing. I'm not sure exactly why, but yeah, I mean, they recognize that there's smart people working there and they want to see what they know. A lot of people that work at Lucid, for example, are former Tesla employees. Their former CEO came from Tesla, and you can sort of think of the Lucid Air as a Tesla Model S, like version two, like the Model S that Tesla, the second generation Model S that Tesla never created. So everybody, it's not a huge amount of people that are working in the space. So they probably recognize that there's a lot of knowledge there for them to tap into.
Does this sort of solidify Lucid as maybe the challenger or maybe the prime challenger to Tesla in the EV space?
I think they have been, at least, you know, Lucid probably thinks of themselves that way. And with a lot of former Tesla employees, they definitely see Lucid definitely sees Tesla as the target. And I think that's what the first Lucid Air was. I mean, that's what the Lucid Air is. It's a competitor to Tesla's Model S. And now the Gravity coming out, it sort of is in between the Tesla Model X and the Tesla Model Y, which is Tesla's SUVs. They sort of priced it in between.
What do you think this deal means for Arizona as a car manufacturing hub, maybe an EV hub, that, you know, these two companies, both of whom had major presences here, one of them was acquired by the other and not allowed to go under. What does that say about Arizona?
Yeah, it is interesting. So the manufacturing plant in Casa Grande that Lucid has to build the Gravity, which is their new SUV, which is their second model, they've done a great they've done a huge expansion there, because essentially they're going to be doubling their output, if not more. You know, the sedan is not the force in the marketplace that it once was. Most consumers buy SUVs, crossovers, trucks, and that's what the Gravity fills. And they see that as a huge opportunity. And so they've expanded their production footprint in Casa Grande already.
So I'm curious how electric vehicle companies, manufacturers, maybe the suppliers, like, how are they viewing the market right now? And we keep seeing and hearing that demand for EVs isn't what it was, maybe not what a lot of the car companies are hoping it would be. And some manufacturers, some car companies are scaling back their EV options. I'm curious how people who are in this world are seeing this current moment.
Well, it takes a long time to plan and develop a car. So it's difficult to derail that, even if there are, you know, some government interactions into that about incentives, about tariffs, et cetera. So it's difficult to derail them quickly. And you already, if you've spent 1 year or 2 years developing a car, typically it takes, you know, 3 to 4 years to get a car from, you know, the design stage into production. It's pretty difficult to shut that off. And you've already spent so much money that you should, you know, basically the manufacturers just choose to continue building them. It's pretty rare that they cancel something, you know, in the middle of the production. So yeah, so they're going to end up selling a lot of EVs. Now, a lot of manufacturers have backed off of promises that were, hey, by 2030, hey, by 2031, by 2028, whatever it is, whatever year it was, we're not going to build any more internal combustion engine cars, or we'll be fully electrified. And that has sort of meant different things to different manufacturers. Some manufacturers, that means they will truly be battery electric vehicle makers. Some manufacturers, that means they'll be hybrids and battery electric vehicles, plug-in hybrids, et cetera. There's a mix of things. But they've sort of backed off. Those who are making the claims about being full 100% battery electric vehicles by whatever date, most of them have backed off of that. And as they launch new electrics into the market, they are sort of just waiting and seeing what consumers want and giving consumers the options that they want.
Does it seem as though there are more companies trying to get into the EV market? I'm thinking specifically of, you know, a company like a Lucid or a Tesla that really that's all they do. Or does it seem as though the companies that are in this space now, that's who's going to be there?
Not necessarily. I mean, Slate, which is an entirely new startup company, a new startup EV company, they announced that they are going to be selling a small pickup truck that can be converted into an SUV. The starting price is supposed to be below $28,000. So with the $7,500 incentive, you're down to about $20,000 with that truck. And they are positioning it in hopes of finding, you know, a lot of first-time EV buyers who couldn't necessarily afford an EV before. So there's a lot of interest in EVs as long as they're inexpensive. I mean, there are some trade-offs to them in terms of practicality. Like, you can't necessarily as easily go on a, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 hour road trip. They're a little bit more complicated for that. They require a little more planning. But if you have charging at home, EVs make a lot of sense for a lot of people. So I don't think we've seen the end of startups. In a lot of ways, it is a bit easier to build an EV than it is to build an internal combustion car. Developing an engine for an internal combustion car is hideously expensive, and then you have to go through all the emissions regulations. With an EV, yes, battery technology is very expensive. Buying batteries is expensive. Some of the stuff is roughly off the shelf, not necessarily tailored for that particular vehicle. And the motors are also something of a commodity where you can buy them. And so you can build an EV a little bit more easily than you could an internal combustion car. So we may not be seeing the end of this. And I think people will also want to follow in the footsteps of Tesla and build, you know, an electric car company with a huge valuation out of absolutely nothing and build electric vehicles and, you know, fill that need for the future. Yeah.
All right. That is Tony Quiroga, editor-in-chief of Car and Driver. Tony, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for your time.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a horror novel gets praise from Stephen King, and its author reflects on a lifelong relationship with the genre.
I have very, very early memories of watching my mom being driven away in an ambulance because she was having an MS attack. And that's a really heavy thing for a kid to process. But if you can also like sit down and watch like The Fly with that kid, it's a little lighter to process in a weird way.
Writer Nat Cassidy talks us through his experience as a horror fan and author. But first, by any standard, Liz Lehrman has had an incredible career. For over 50 years, she's been creating original dance theater and choreography, writing books, and teaching. She ran the world-renowned Liz Lehrman Dance Exchange for decades, and more recently, she's been a professor at ASU. She's also been a Guggenheim Fellow, the recipient of a MacArthur Grant, and her work has been commissioned by prestigious theaters and academic institutions all over the country, like Harvard, Arena Stage, and the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. But what is her artistic legacy? Lehrman recently turned 77, and while she is hardly slowing down, that is a question she's been thinking about a lot. Not just for herself, but in general, for any artist. What are you supposed to leave behind? It's a complex intellectual notion, and so, as she's always done, Lehrman has been exploring it through movement. For an ongoing project called My Body is a Library, she's been working towards what she calls an atlas of creative tools, a way of leaving a record for future artists about how to find a creative practice that leads to meaningful work. The project is ongoing, but as Lehrman told me recently, there are two words, or maybe values, that she knows are core parts of her vision: conviction and investment.
What I think underlies those words, you might be able to do something that helps someone else or makes a change that perhaps can be for the better, even though my field did not see that. It's not like dance said, oh, yeah, we need you to do political work, or we want you to work with the old people. Or No. That was not in the dance field at all.
Yeah.
And to be honest, even at ASU, which is an amazingly innovative, incredible institution, I still have to sort of fight my way into saying, and this stuff counts.
Yeah.
It counts.
Well, this makes me think of, I heard you say in an interview once that your father did civil rights work and your mom was an artist, a painter, if I'm not mistaken?
She was an unfulfilled artist of many things. I would say a gardener, okay, piano player, and wanderer.
Right, right. But you said in this conversation that I heard you have that what you just articulated, mm-hmm, this idea that what you do ought to impact other people and outlast you, that was something you got from him, and that what you got from her was what I'm now realizing in this moment is what we might call conviction, this idea that if you want to make it as an artist, it has to be vitally important to you for it to be at all important to anybody else.
and that we could kind of see your career as the marriage of those two impulses.
And thank you for saying that and for bringing them into the space, because I mean, into our room, because I do feel that way.
Yeah. So this makes me think of the questions that have kind of been at the core of your dance practice. Where is the dance happening? Who is it that's doing it? And what is the story that it's telling? Mm. If I'm not mistaken, you made your first dance in 1974?
Yes. Yes, of course. New York City winter.
Did you have a sense for yourself right from the beginning of the import of those questions when you were making that dance? Mm.
I don't think so. I think they were driving me. Sometimes I think it's when you're deeply in trouble that when you've tried everything else and nothing you know works, and then you are thrust into the situation where you have to try something else, that's when I think those things start to prove to be true.
Okay. Could you give me an example of that?
I think if I think about, you know, certainly the big change is my mother's death in particular. It's like, what was I going to do at that point as a person in their 20s? And when I went looking in my what was my then choreographic toolbox, and I had gone through some good institutions and I'd been brought up in a Western way of thinking about dance, there should be a lot of tools in that toolbox. They were totally useless when your mother dies and you're 27 and you're like, wait, I don't care about shape. I had to go through a system that I devised in the moment that I should find out what a sad shape was. Oh, it's a curve. Oh, how many ways can I curve my spine might lead me to understanding a way to think about grief.
That's really interesting. So there's that question, what is the story that the dance is telling? Mm. That was a fairly personal story that you were telling, but you have also done work that addresses the political.
I think political is personal. Like, it's personal to me what our government spends in the defense budget. I mean, I feel personally about it. Wait, it's my dollar. And do I really want it to do that thing? And so my curiosity about the defense budget was one of the early political pieces. I mean, it wasn't that I was going to change the system or I wasn't going to be an activist. I just needed to understand. Part of my curiosity is that all subject matters should be possible, not just love and death. It is the stuff of our life. But secondly, I would say, and then this is maybe more like the way I think about art making in general, is that there is the performance piece, but there's all the stuff you do on the way to get into the performance. All the interviewing, all the talking to people, all the workshops, all the testing, all that stuff. Right now, that feels to me really important. Mm. I just think people need to be in close relationship to each other in a humane way, deeply engaged in something that matters to them. And sitting in a circle with librarians to hear their stories, maybe move a little bit together, tell why they ever decided to become librarians in the first place. This, to me, is really important cultural work. I mean, the first way we're experimenting with a project happened to come out of a thing at the Harvard Law Library, where they, most of the books that deal with Latin American law and other countries' law is in the basement. And for years, they've been meaning to bring them upstairs. But when we heard this, my colleague, Paloma McGregor, said, oh, well, let's make that the dance. And we are. And so we're actually moving the books. And the audience is going to get to actually put a book on a shelf. And we're going to actually, you know.
But it also, if I may, speaks to the idea of space. And you invoked the idea of space earlier when we were talking about your parents, bringing them into the space. I mean, I guess now that I'm talking about it, this is one of your questions. Where is the dance taking place? Why is it important to you for not just the dancers, but the audience to be so aware of the space where the dance is happening?
For one thing, it takes people out of their passivity. We did a project where each character had their own room, and the audience wandered through this incredible array of beautiful rooms, and you got to sort of know the kid. And then eventually you came on stage, and you listened to two people, and then you took your seat. So that we had a theater goer who's a big donor in Washington, D.C., and she'd gone to that. She came up to me after. She said, listen, I've gone to a million. I've never been on the stage that I then sat and watched, and it changed everything for me. It feels entirely about a certain reverence for our bodies and what they're capable of, a wish that we could have relationships with them that allowed for the kind of knowledge bearing that I feel lives in our bodies. Mm-hmm. I know that's not the first place people go when they think about how do we know things, and there's just, we're diminished by not having this relationship.
Another thing I heard you say in an interview once is that early in your dance career, you would actually be told, leave your mind outside, just bring your body in.
Well, this was a comment I made, and I was thinking about it just yesterday because I was thinking about authoritarianism. And, you know, the arts are not exempt from authoritarianism. And classical ballet, I mean, it's so much better now, and there's so many amazing people in the classical ballet world. So if you're out there listening, I'm not condemning the whole field. But by and large, the way I was raised in classical ballet, it is an authoritarian regime. And they told me, literally, leave your brain outside. And that is what authoritarians want. They do not want people to think. And I think coming to grips with that within my dance world and challenging that and saying, wait a minute.
Right. I mean, I guess that brings us to your last question. We've talked about the story the dance is telling and where it's happening. But that's that last piece, who is doing the dance.
The who. In the few dances I've made where I really care about the steps, most of the time I'm willing to revise everything because it's a different person and they're going to do it differently. And finding that relationship between what that person is thinking, doing, and feeling in the moment in which they're, you know, extending their arm out or something like that, it matters, yeah.
Well, Liz Lehrman is so many things, a choreographer, a writer, an educator, a speaker, professor at ASU, and our guest today on the show. Liz, thank you for this conversation.
Oh, thank you. I had such a good time. Thank you, Sam.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. And now it's time for the next installment of our Conversations with Arizona Makers called Made in Arizona.
To take risk with embroidery in a way that I couldn't take risks in other areas of art.
A lot of my paintings, gravity doesn't matter a whole lot.
Dance wasn't something that is necessarily seen in galleries, you know? And I just remember being like, this is the key. This is how dance gets out there.
I try to tug at people's heartstrings. I try to do something disturbing.
I escaped real life and I went back in time.
Today, we meet Danielle Wood, a ceramicist and ceramics teacher in the Valley. She often uses the ocean as inspiration for her work, despite living and working in the desert. My co-host Mark Brody visited her studio, surrounded by pieces she's done and bags of clay ready to be turned into art. He asked what first got her interested in doing ceramics.
I got into ceramics. I was a painting and drawing major at Arizona State University, and I loved to draw, and I loved art, and I took a ceramics class because I had a 3D credit, and I just fell in love with ceramics and just loved the three-dimensional quality of it, being able to sculpt, and it just, for me, it just felt like the right art for me.
Did that surprise you at the time, given that you were interested in art, but a very different kind of art?
It did surprise me because at that time, in my mind, I was thinking, well, I'm going to be an art major, I'll be a painter, you know, that is art, you know. And so then becoming an art student, realizing, wow, there's so many different subjects and mediums. So I had a friend that was a painter and his sister was a ceramicist. And he also recommended it and was like, you might like ceramics just with some of the things that I like to do. It just, you know, could be a really great opportunity to try this medium and just see where it goes.
Was it the kind of thing that you like immediately dove right in head first? I mean, you were coming from painting and drawing. Did you sort of, pardon the pun, dip your toe in the water a little bit? Or were you like all in right away?
Well, it's funny because a lot of times when it comes to decisions, I think about these things a lot. And it was one of those things that I did painting and I loved it and I felt like I was good at it. But when I started doing ceramics, it just felt like a language where it felt like I really love this and I felt like I could truly express the things, my ideas in it. And so after that first semester, you know, I just noticed I was spending more time in the ceramics department than I was in the painting department. I still love painting. I still love drawing. And that's something I love about ceramics is I can still, you know, explore color with ceramics. And so it just felt like for me that ceramics really combined all the things I loved about art.
So where do you, like, how do you conceive of these? I know that the ocean is a big inspiration for you. How do you conceive of, like, what specifically you want to do? Because that's a pretty vast area that you can choose subjects from.
That's a really good question. For me, you know, I'm very interested in a lot of times like coral reefs and the smaller organisms. And so I love the ocean. And it's definitely, when you look at my Instagram feed, there's a lot of ocean forms on there. But I love the corals because they call it the garden of the ocean. And so it really works with some of my forms, these little smaller pieces that I can recreate, like even these forms. There's an algae called the mermaid's wine glass. And so that was what started that trumpet shape for me. I'm very interested in corals.
So I've got to ask, because we do not live near an ocean here, like, how do you try to get access to corals? Like, I know you can obviously go online and see millions of images of them, but is it a detriment that it's not, you know, just down the road or a short drive to go see the ocean or even sit by the ocean?
I do. Whenever I do vacations, a lot of times I'll go by the water. But also in grad school, I was studying a lot of different forms from the ocean. And so a lot of that just comes back in my memory of things that I really was drawn to. But also, yeah, I think a lot of my early childhood experience of just going to the ocean. And then I've also done snorkeling in different spaces like Hawaii, and I've gone to the Grand Caymans and done snorkeling. So that's another way that I kind of also recollect, like, you know, things that I've seen. So a little bit of everything.
Well, what is it about the ocean that speaks to you so much?
I would say, well, so when I was in grad school, my thesis was the ocean as a metaphor for the subconscious. And so it's that idea. I think what I love is that it's very mysterious. There's a lot of surreal aspects to it, that it's this liminal space where there's so much unknown. For us, I feel like the ocean is almost like space in that way, that there's creatures and animals that we haven't discovered yet. So there's just so much mystery. And for me, the inspiration is endless in that way. So that's what draws me to the ocean.
Well, as you were talking, the word mystery really popped into my head. I'm curious how you try to incorporate that into a sculpture.
I like to, a lot of these will have holes in them, and I like that idea of the shadow, that it's like there's these kind of negative spaces, and so that's something for me, and then also forms that are very abstract. So I've also, even as a painter, like I love Georgia O'Keeffe's work because it was very abstract and looking at nature. And so I think for me, the mystery part is creating work that's very unique, very, I like that idea of like negative space and places where it leaves it up to the viewer to kind of look and want to get closer and investigate.
So when you are in the water or by the water, do you take photos? Do you like just capture it all in your brain? Like, how do you try to bring what you see when you're in the water or near it back to your studio?
That's a good question. I a little bit of both. Like, I'm constantly taking photos. So even on my Instagram, that's like a big part of my feed, is just things that I'm inspired by, textures that I see. A lot of times they're not in the ocean, but it's just things that I love that have that symmetry and repetition. And so I think that helps with the abstraction, because some of this is coming from the ocean, but some of it is also in my everyday life, things that I like.
I'm curious, given the fact that you started out in painting and drawing and then seemingly fell in love with ceramics, do you look at other mediums or other like art forms and maybe try to incorporate those as well? Because you went from one that you really liked to another that you seemingly like better. Do you think there's maybe something you could like even better than ceramics, or maybe that you want to incorporate into your ceramics?
Well, it's interesting. Like, I taught a glass class. I teach at Glendale Community College and Schemer Arts Center. And I taught a glass class at Glendale Community College. And so glass is something that I've been interested in. Like, I would love to take a class in glass blowing. So that's been something I've been interested to combine with my work. But I really love also just sculpture in general. But I'm also very safety conscious. So that's like a big thing for me. Like, I'm all about, like, that was the tricky thing in glass is I was like, okay, don't get glass in my eye. Like, that would be the worst. So it's, you know, I'm very safety that, like, the worst, you know, the thing we are most careful in ceramics is dust. And so, you know, as long as that is taken care of and, you know, you're wearing gloves while you're glaze mixing, you're good for the most part, you know, and you're careful around the kilns. That's the other. So yeah, I would say sculpture materials, you know, some of these 3D printing, I'm really interested in that.
Danielle Wood is a ceramic artist in the Valley. She also teaches ceramics. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Last month, Nat Cassidy published his fifth novel, When the Wolf Comes Home. It's a horror story about a young boy and an aspiring actress both being pursued by a violent, vicious monster. The book has already been called a classic by no less than Stephen King. As Cassidy told me recently, that was a big deal, not just because Stephen King is Stephen King, but because when Cassidy was a kid here in Phoenix, books by King and other horror authors helped Cassidy make sense of the world.
I grew up on 32nd Street and Bell in the, you know, early 80s through the mid to late 90s. And at the time, especially when I was younger, on one side of the intersection, we had our grocery store, which was a Smitty's. And then the other side was nothing. And it kind of informed, I think, an outlook that I had, which was I needed to be able to provide my own entertainment and my own connection.
Well, I'm really glad that you brought up this idea of having to generate your own entertainment and to do it in your immediate surroundings, because I've also heard you talk about these rows of mass market paperbacks that lined the shelf of your house when you were a kid. And people will perhaps be able to see where this is going, but they all seem to have fit into a particular genre. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, my mom was a huge horror fan. So there was just Stephen King and Dean Koontz and Clive Barker and Anne Rice. I don't know. It put those titles specifically in like this vaunted, totemic sort of position in my mind as a kid. And I was raised by a single working mom who couldn't really afford to like police the things that my brother and I were reading. So she was basically like, once you think you're ready for these books, you can read them.
You said another thing once that stuck in my mind and that feels connected there, which is that you had the sense that part of your mom's love of those books was that it was, and this is a quote, a way to metabolize the awfulness. Mm. Can you tell me what you meant by that?
Yeah, my mom, so again, she was a single working mom in the 80s and 90s, which was no easy time to be a single working mom. Not that it's ever easy, but she was also dealing with MS and had been dealing with MS since she was like in her 20s. So it had been a long road already with a progressive disease. And there was always the sense that sooner or later it was going to start getting worse and worse and worse. And so she was dealing with that while also dealing with, you know, being a woman in the workplace and occasionally trying to like go on a date and also raising two sons all by herself. And so that was a lot of really challenging, you know, existentially dreadful things. I got the sense from a very early age that the stories that she was drawn to enabled her to pressure release a little bit, to knock the sort of anxieties that she was dealing with down a few pegs, and to also in a way like communicate with me and my brother about these very heavy things that we would be over the course of our life, you know, be asked to integrate into the way that we understand the world.
Wow.
You know, like I have very, very early memories of watching my mom being driven away in an ambulance because she was having an MS attack and that's a really heavy thing for a kid to process. But if you can also like sit down and watch like The Fly with that kid, it's a little lighter to process in a weird way.
Yeah, it sounds like if I'm hearing you right, it gave you guys a language to communicate, to communicate about these things. I have to say, it makes me think about the thing that I connected with the most personally about When the Wolf Comes Home, which is the character of Jess. Because Jess is somebody who fundamentally is in the prime of her life, and her life has not gone the way that she wanted her life to go.
Yeah.
And she has huge dreams, and it's just not working, and she can't figure out how to get it to work. And then obviously the circumstances of the book sweep her up into a new life where all of a sudden she's like, okay, I guess this is my life now.
Yeah.
And the thing that I loved so much about that is that that doesn't feel like the premise of a horror novel to me necessarily. That feels like just an extraordinarily human connection to be able to make with a character. And if that's where she is, and I buy that state of mind that she's in, I would follow that character anywhere, whether it was, you know, fleeing a horrifying monster or, you know, if you were writing in some completely different genre. It just seemed like you had invested so much in the emotional truth of Jess.
I'm so glad you framed it this way, because sometimes I will rankle when people refer to Jess in reviews or something like that as a failed actress.
Oh.
And that makes me so mad, because she is not a failed actress. She's an actress whose dreams aren't coming true, as you've just said.
Yeah.
This book is attempting to kind of dramatize the way that the primary color of fear refracts and distills until it becomes this shapeless thing that you can't run away from.
Yeah. It's not that you escape it. It's that you just come to terms with it. You almost make friends with it.
Yeah. It was a weirdly similar journey through my relationship with horror as a genre, even, because like as I described earlier, like I was a morbid, horror obsessed little kid, and I was walking through a Blockbuster, as was my want, as was all of our wants at the time.
Yeah.
And I was always drawn to the horror section, because I would just like look at the covers of these VHS, and they were so mind-blowingly scary and garish and weird and wild and beautiful. And I was always like, what stories could these images even be from? How does anyone watch this? And there was one cover in particular, which was De Palma's Carrie. There was just something about Sissy Spacek covered in blood with her eyes wide open, and she just looked so shocked and horrified, and I was terrified of her. I saw Carrie everywhere when I was a little kid, and I eventually had to beg my mom to tell me the story of Carrie, just to like help me get my little brain hands around it. And she told it to me in such a way that Carrie wasn't a figure to be feared, but to be loved, to be sorry for, that she was this girl who didn't ask for these horrible things to happen and people pushed her too far. And from that point on, I started talking to her when I was alone as a little kid. Like I would literally say out loud, like, please don't hurt me, Carrie. I'm so sorry they were mean to you. I'll be your friend. Let me be your friend. Just don't hurt me.
Oh, Ned.
So it was like just like such such a kind of silly, kind of stupid little kid logic, but there's something so pure about that. And it really did represent how I started to look at horror as a thing that you do have to learn to live with. You have to find a way to talk to the things that scare you. And, you know, they might still scare you, but eventually you'll come to realize that, you know, it doesn't have to be a vampiric relationship or a parasitic relationship, but like we can work together, you and me, fear. Like we can kind of find an agreement, a co-op, as it were.
Well, Nat Cassidy is the author of the new book, When the Wolf Comes Home. Nat, thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh, man, my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that will do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. But, dear listener, It is not everything that we wanted to tell you about. Today, as every day, we have so much we want to talk about on the show, and it's always more than can fit in just 1 hour. And if you feel the same, if you get to the end of the show every day and you think, I need more, I'm craving more, we have a great solution for you. We have a brand new weekly newsletter. We call it Radioheads, and you can have it delivered directly to your inbox. Every Thursday, right after the show, you will get this newsletter, and it will contain all kinds of wonderful things. It might be some extra information from an interview subject, or notes from members of our team on themes we talked about on the show today. And you will also get these really lovely original illustrations by our assistant digital editor, Claire Lawton. So, join us as we take you behind the scenes by signing up for Radioheads. You can sign up when you go to tinyurl.com/theshowradioheads. That's tinyurl.com/theshowradioheads, or you can find it at kjzz.org. So we hope to talk to you in the pages of Radioheads, but also right back here tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. Thank you, as always, for listening.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.